Бастрыкин, реально верите,
Алексей что Кудрин писал... ищет место поближе к...
Александр Владимиру Иванович Кудрин? Придумал еще один...
И Алексей Кудрин, который, как
да, сейчас... Бастрыкина не комментирую и не...
Значит, Алексею Кудрину, соответственно, про которого мы начали это обсуждение, найдется...
National ideology, political indoctrination, ramped up repression, censorship and surveillance. That's one vision for Russia's future we saw earlier this week in a controversial and widely discussed article in Kommersant Vlast by investigative committee head Alexander Bastrykin. It's been called everything from a clear call for a restoration of the Soviet system to a manifesto for the North Koreanization of Russia. Later in the week, we got another vision. Former Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin accepted an offer to head the Kremlin's top economics think tank and write Vladimir Putin's economic plan. Kudrin called for a fundamental modernization and restructuring of Russia's economy, but added that such a restructuring would be contingent on establishing a more pluralistic and accountable political system. It's not unusual for the Kremlin to send mixed signals, but what this week's contradictory messaging seems to suggest is that the Putin regime has concluded that the status quo is unsustainable. And if that's so, what comes next? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining us from Washington, D.C., making his first but hopefully not last appearance on the podcast, is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. God, that's a mouthful. Welcome to the podcast, Don. Good to have you. Also joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. Welcome back, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. It's been a while. It's good to have you back. Been too long. Don, let's start with you. We got this tradition here. First time on the podcast, you get the first question, so you're on the spot. In a widely discussed article this week, the Moscow-based political analyst Nikolai Petrov argued that Russia's political regime in its current form is unsustainable. And we see now Bastrykin and Kudrin coming out with two alternatives. Bastrykin's basically arguing go back to Andropovism, and Kudrin's arguing for a new perestroika. These things are pretty much polar opposites. Are Bastrykin and Kudrin's actions this week indicative of the unsustainability of the current regime? And what do these proposals for change in diametrically opposing directions show us about what's happening inside the elite? What do you see happening here?
You go right to the core of the question. I think that I agree with Collier's article. The system is not sustainable, but I'm not necessarily convinced that these two opposing points of view reflect any views of the elite on that question. I think you see the reflection that a lot of parts of the elite disagree on key issues, that Putin does not always control what's going on, but you also see bureaucratic politics in play, especially with Bastrykin. Mm. So while I think I would separate the questions, is the regime sustainable? That's one discussion. And second, do these things reflect any elite sense of that? And I think largely not. I think what the system is doing, Brian, is positioning itself for the upcoming elections. And so you see a lot of new things going on. I almost said reset, but let's not say that. It's positioning itself, guys. And when it's doing this, it's taking into account of a number of possibilities, some of which for them are not pleasant. But I think that's really what's reflected here, as well as the bureaucratic politics of the immediate moment.
Well, let's stick with that for a minute, because what do you see going on with Bastrykin? Because one of the theories that's been put out there, and I know Mark Galeotti, who unfortunately we can't have with us today, but he'd be great to have on this topic. He wrote a piece where one of the theories he put out there was that basically Bastrykin feels threatened because of the restructuring within the security services, the creation of the National Guard, the restructuring of the Interior Ministry. And this was a cry for attention from Bastrykin. That's certainly one interpretation. Do you see something like that going on?
I think that Putin makes decisions quickly, this not being the only one. And I think it sounded to me like Bastrykin was taken to somewhat off balance, and he's sort of advertising himself for his particular disgusting, admittedly, point of view. I thought it was interesting that he did not publish that interview in Российская газета.
Or Известия.
Or Известия, given it more of a Putin-esque flavor. So I think, to a large extent, I think it's his own views and those of some of the people around him reflecting the bureaucratic dimension of what I said, which is that the power ministries are being reshuffled with an uncertain end, and he's in some ways auditioning for a prominent role in that.
Mm-hmm. No, that was when I saw this published in Commerce on Vlast, which basically, let's face it, is a publication that's read more by the liberal Moscow intelligentsia than anybody. I found it odd, but then I noticed how much play this was getting on Russian television, which also I found interesting. And I was putting it in the context of just things that were happening. The hit job on Navalny on Russia One a couple of weeks ago. The creation of the National Guard. Today, yesterday, we saw the Duma proposing that the National Guard be allowed to shoot into crowds of civilians. That I touched on this in the Daily Vertical video this morning. So you could look at it in that context, or you could look at it in this bureaucratic context. I tend to be moving in the direction where you are, Don. Sean, what are your thoughts on this?
I put this in the context of the upcoming Duma elections, and they represent kind of, you know, two polar extremes, as you pointed out, and Bystrykin, I mean, I was reading it yesterday, and it really is the kind of ranting of a paranoid psychotic in many cases.
It's unbelievable.
I think the one editorial in Viedomosti that basically noted quite astutely, I forget who wrote it, but that it really shows that the way Bystrykin sees Russia is completely counter opposite to the Putin narrative, in the sense that it's teetering on the edge of collapse. And I found that's an interesting irony.
And I cited that in the Morning Vertical newsletter this week and made the argument that if you believe Bystrykin, Russia's on the verge of collapse and the security services are completely incompetent.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
There's all these American spies running around.
And ascribing these kind of wondrous powers to the American, you know, security.
Damn, service. I wish we were that good.
I mean, they do too. Like the CIA, of course, wishes they were too, right? I mean, but they can't even find interpreters for Arabic. But I think putting this into historical context, I mean, in many respects, both Kudrin and Bystrykin are part of, you know, two general ideologies within the elites that we've seen for many, many decades. I mean, I started looking at Kudrin's speech that Sloan published, but I don't have a subscription to Sloan, so I couldn't read all of it. But the first kind of part, I thought it was really interesting that he started referencing the reforms under Khrushchev. Mm-hmm. He started referencing the reforms under Gorbachev. Yep. And, you know, both of these figures, I think, represent, you know, hardliners and softliners within the Kremlin elite that have existed in the 19th century, that existed throughout the 20th communist period. And I think Kudrin's references to these two post-war reform periods is indicative of that. But for me, it also suggests that if these two figures are representative of, you know, Poles and the elite, that elite thinking in Russia is actually really limited.
Yeah,
they're going back to the same things. Bystrykin, strengthen the state. We're a besieged fortress. Internal, external enemies. We have to increase, you know, the security apparatus. Kudrin, we have to, you know, build up institutions from below. We have to better the judicial system. We have to engage in some sort of market reforms. This is a script that has been played over and over and over again. And as some people have pointed out about Kudrin's appointment to this economic council, these economic plans have been made repeatedly in the last 16 years, and none of them were actually implemented to any extent.
Well, there's a reason for that, though. I mean, and this is something I was harping on all week. If you implement what Alexei Kudrin is proposing, as limited as it is, you're going to undermine the corrupt fundamentals of this regime. This is an economy based on rent sinking, based on corruption, based on centralization. You introduce actual market mechanisms, whether you think that's a good idea or not, you're going to undermine the fundamentals of this regime. Alexei Kudrin's plan equals regime change if it's actually implemented, does it not?
I would point out, though, that there are elements of all of these economic plans, and Kudrin being one of them, and that is cutting the welfare state.
Right. That's you one know, of the
this
elements.
This is one of the things that they've actually put forward is the yes. cutting of the welfare state. And this is part of his plan, too. Yeah, he would love to, you know, better rule of law and make it the climate better for investors. But at the same time, he also is calling for the cutting of the welfare state.
No, he's –
and
this
it's
is
the same, – and it's the same macroeconomic liberal – economic philosophy, neoliberalism that Europe has tried, the United States has tried, and it doesn't work economically. The problem with Russia is that if you engage in some sort of Keynesianism, it's perfect for just skimming off the top. So
right. Neither of the Western theories. Friedman yeah. doesn't work and Keynes doesn't work.
Yeah, because as you said, it's built on rent-seeking
corruption. But this is you correctly outlined part of Kudrin's philosophy, but the other part of it is the part where I think he's dead on right. That no economic reform is going to work unless you have good institutions.
That's
and
true.
Russia doesn't have good institutions. And yep. he keeps making this argument. And remember that piece, his speech at the Higher School of Economics began saying institutions are more important than economists. And no
yes.
matter how wonderful your economic plan is, it's not going to work unless you have proper institutions. And this is what I mean when I say you implement Kudrin's plan. I'm thinking of it in a very holistic way.
Sure.
And you implement Kudrin's plan, this regime collapses in a week, right? Because you take out, maybe not a week, but you take out the corrupt foundation of the regime.
But I would point out, though, that the interesting thing about strengthening institutions, in order to do that, the system would have to implement forms of coercion to do it, because you can't allow – these institutions aren't going to suddenly flower from below. I mean, Russia has been trying to decentralize these institutions and develop them for decades.
Yeah.
But in
See,
order
I would argue
it,
they haven't.
Well, they there's
they
been
say
these
they have.
Well, yeah, there's been these proposals, and they haven't worked for a variety of reasons, right? But the thing is that in order for this reform to happen from above, which is essentially Kudrin is saying to develop these institutions, you would have to use coercion, because you would have to basically purge out
yeah.
all of the corrupt elements at the local level.
Well, this is one of the paradoxes that almost all post-communist societies had. Some of it got it done quick and effectively very early, like Estonia, for example, and others have muddled through. Don, why don't you jump in here? What are your thoughts on some?
I have to say that I agree with both of you guys. I kept when I read the speech my three times, I kept thinking Yulinsky would have said the same thing.
yeah. No.
There have always been plans on the table, as Sean said, going back to Yulinsky, but there have not. They've not been done much about it, as both of you say. Yes, it would absolutely blow up the regime or collapse the regime. And that's why it's not going to happen. But my other point would be that people like Bastrykhin and systemic liberals like Kudrin, they play a role in the governing of the system. Because if it's a sock to that, I think, Brian, you said that Moscow intelligentsia,
right.
who think that there's some hope that if only things get worse or the oil prices go further down, Putin's going to pull this out of his pocket and implement it. And Sean is exactly right. This is, in many ways, a deeper cultural problem of patrimonial
right.
rule, which is not going to be cured by a blueprint, no matter who writes it up, let alone by Kudrin. I would also note that Kudrin's hands are not really that all completely clean in the construction of this regime.
No.
Sean, Brian, you remember when he was in power 15 years ago. In many ways, you could say he was an enabler of the oligarchic.
I refer to him as a mafia accountant.
I like that. I'm Italian-American, so I didn't want to use the M word.
I don't think you have a monopoly on that word anymore.
Exactly. But Kudrin and Bastrykhin both serve a systemic governing function, which is far less than threatening the regime. In many ways, it's blah, blah, and it's out there. So some people in Moscow will be more likely to support whatever happens in the regime.
One thing a question I raised this week was that what drives people like Kudrin and Ella Pamphilova? I mean, I had the two of them were on my mind because of a Pamphilova's decision about the elections in the Moscow suburb this week, about that she canceled unexpectedly. Kudrin taking this position as the head of the Center for Strategic Reform. I mean, do they really think they can change the system from within? Are they just cynical? Or do they really think they can change the system from within? Because I don't think you can change the system from within. I think this system is unchangeable. I think there was a time maybe when you could have, but I think that time is long past. What do you think is driving people like Kudrin and Pamphilova to still play along ambition or
ambition. I think they have some intellectual commitment to a certain point of view, but how realistic do they think it is? I mean, you and I and John obviously agree that it isn't. I think the Moscow intelligentsia from which Kudrin comes is a relatively coddled group anyway, relatively out of touch with what's going on in the provinces, wherever Kolya is today. And to some extent, it's an intellectual debate very similar to some kind of the dysfunctional debates we have around DuPont's circle.
Right. Sean, what do you – Sean, what do you
– Yeah, you know, they – I don't know how – I can't say how much they are kind of true believers in the sense of their ability to actually affect massive change in the system. But their positions, of course, give influence. They give notoriety. They give – you know, they're the type of people, particularly Kudrin, who, you know, a lot of people go to for advice. A lot of people see him as an authoritative figure. So there's I think there's probably a lot of personal – gratification for this, right? I mean, he's a smart man. He's an effective person. He's a good thinker in terms. He's very good at what he does.
No, I think he's intellectually honest to a point.
Absolutely,
to
a point. And but you know, many systems have these types of people who think that they can maybe not completely change things, but make things a bit more tolerable within the system, to tinker with it, to apply some changes. And I think both of these figures are – this is why I think they participate in the system, because – and on the other hand too, they fear the – I think they somewhat buy into the narrative that if you don't work within the system, you get chaos.
Right.
I mean, so this is one of the few avenues to actually affect some sort of change on the system, however futile that may seem.
Yeah, I'm curious to watch, because Pamphilova this week said if there's fraud in the elections in September, she's going to resign. I'm like, you better get that resignation letter ready, because you better, because, I mean, come on. Are these elections going to be clean? Of course they're not going to be clean. What's she going
to
do?
I actually have to say something about that, because I think that in the context of what we're talking about and putting it in as the opening kind of the election season, let's just put it there. The middle ground is probably going to be the path things go, right? But a lot of this depends on the system itself, because clearly United Russia is going to take some kind of hit.
Yeah.
Question is how much of a hit they're going to allow. If they're smart, which there isn't a lot of smart strategic thinking going on nowadays, but okay, let's – if they were, they would allow it to take a hit – and fudge things enough to maintain the majority, to give the air of legitimacy, basically to do
that's what they did in 2011.
The Navalny operation in Moscow on a national scale.
Yeah, although they tried that in 2011. No.
Well, I think the falsifications of 2011 were actually, you know, too massive
and too visible.
And too visible, right? Because what they need to realize that and this is the problem with the Bystrykin narrative, because the paranoia prevents any kind of sober thinking of the landscape. Yeah. Because they, you know, who's going to gain United Russia's votes? It's going to be the KPRF or you know,
LDPR.
Just Russia, and they're loyal oppositionists. They can tolerate that kind of that opening of the space in the political system. And I think it's interesting, too. Also, I would put into this context Putin's comments about there needing new blood in the system, which, you know, one can ridicule, of course, since his blood is very old and calcified. but his kind of sneering at United Russia in general.
Yeah, oh, his comments during the live call-in show were interesting. Yeah.
Right. So. You know, that's another way too, another possibility, and perhaps a middle way to try to inject some sort of dynamism into the system, which that dynamism has been lost since, I think, 2011.
God, it's seeming we're going back to this old – remember we were talking about managed pluralism back in 2010, 2011, and it never happened, and that led to the crisis that led us where we are now.
Exactly.
But this was what Surkov was arguing for then. It didn't happen. After watching Putin's call-in last week, God, Surkov would have never let this disaster happen. He would have never let this disaster happen. Don, you want to jump in here on anything?
Yeah, add a point, Brian, which is to say, I think Kudrin in his remarks, shows a more or less strategic vision about what he thinks should happen for the country. And I think there's a big disconnect between that and the way that the real Kremlin operate. And I think we haven't spent much. Thank God Sean brought it up about Mr. Big, Putin himself. And I think it's a very ad hoc kind of governing style. It's a response to crises, things that surprise you, like the power ministries shakeup or the invasion of Ukraine. These have in some ways an ad hoc character that imply Putin himself and few others make the decision, but imply also that he's not really that interested really in the kind of strategic vision that Kudrin articulates. They want to maintain power, perpetuate the regime, and I think a lot of these steps we're talking about are geared to that end and not really that much further down the road.
Now, along these lines, but a little bit of a segue. Tatiana Stanovaya had a really interesting piece in Intersection magazine this week. I don't know if any of you saw it, where she was basically saying that the fear of revolution, the fear of popular uprising, has gone from the theoretical and the propaganda to the real in the minds of the elite. She's making this argument, basing it on the creation of the National Guard and everything we've seen around that. She didn't mention Bastrykin's piece. But she based a lot of this on what's going on with this, with the creation of the National Guard. And I want to quote, she says, "The Kremlin is devising a new toolkit based on the fact that revolutionary attempts in Russia are not only possible, but probable." That this is no longer a propaganda talking point. They really believe this is going to happen. They're putting the toolkit together to prepare for it. This is the Duma election is obviously the flashpoint where we expect this. What do you make of that? Do you agree with her, Don?
I think it's a bit overstated, but basically, yes, I do. I mean, this concern goes back to the Orange and revolution in Ukraine. And you see, especially in election years, you see this apparent threat rise and fall. And I think it's correct to say it's rising right now. So I would basically agree with her.
But go ahead. But they in the past, they tend to deal with this very more deftly. They created Nashi. They co-opted people that might have turned into, you know, the people that would have created a Maidan. It was a different way of playing it. Now they're hitting it with a sledgehammer, which suggests there's heightened fear. No,
I agree, Brian. But I think maybe in 2011-12 they were surprised by the extent of the disturbances. They had sort of managed approach to things, and I think it was maybe the reaction was stronger than they expected. Now they're taking the precaution again. And of course, we have the Maidan and the memories of that relatively fresh in people's minds.
Sean, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the 2011-2012 is weighing on them heavily. And also from their perspective, I do think that they do believe, say, the U.S. is out to get them, right? And according to their understanding of that world where they're out to get them, the U.S. is out to get them, elections are the preferred method of regime change by the so-called script, right? And so they're implementing a bunch of prophylactic measures to prepare for that because they believe there's a conspiracy. Now, the thing about it is that they could definitely overreach on this. Yeah. Right. I mean, but at the same time, they could never implement any of this we might never hear about the National Guard again in any real capacity. But they're getting ready for it. And I think Bastrykin's, article is indicative of that as well.
Indicative of the fact that others in the elite are worried about this as well, for bureaucratic reasons or other reasons.
Bureaucratic or other reasons. I mean, I agree with the point about bureaucracy. I mean, when reading this Bastrykin piece, it just speaks like, I need bigger budgets.
I need more money. Right? I need more power.
I need more power. What is my role? And my role can be this extrajudicial, passing down, judging what is extremism and what isn't extremism. One of the things that's interesting about the Bastrykin piece is how many extremisms there are floating around, right? There's Islamic extremism, there's liberal extremism, there's ethnic tension, and it really is a kind
and
of
it's all orchestrated in Washington.
It's all orchestrated in Washington, but it speaks to, it is a reflection of how people like him in that milieu see the disturbances of Russia, not just in terms of them coming emanating from abroad, but that there are internal fissures within society, and the only way they understand how to deal with them is to pull out the sledgehammer.
One of the things, although one of the reasons I found Bastrykin's piece disturbing was that there is kind of a history of things Bastrykin has proposed in articles actually happening, like the confiscation of property in the past, like taking the investigative committee out from under the wing of the prosecutor's office and making it an independent entity all to itself that reports to the Kremlin. He has a history of proposing things that happen. And that made me nervous. The flip side is Bastrykin has very few allies in the elite. He's kind of Putin's personal politics cop, you know, in a lot of ways. But he's not particularly close to Putin, but his only constituency is really Putin. And that points to kind of weakness if that's your only constituency and you're not particularly close to the man. I don't know, Don, did you have any thoughts on that?
I agree with you, Brian. I would go to the latter.
The latter, yeah. No, I mean, there were pieces saying this is a show of weakness, actually, when you have to...
You're absolutely right that he has a history of this kind of thing more or less coming true. But I think right now I would see it more as, wouldn't Sean say, prophylactic
right kind
of thing. And he may believe this, and we don't know. He may believe this, but I don't think the regime is convinced, especially Mr. Big.
Okay, well let's shift to the regime. It's a good way to segue into our second section when we'll look at the sustainability of the regime. More in a few moments. We'll continue our discussion and zero in on a rather bold prediction Nikolai Petrov made in his article this week. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Спорить будем об эпохе Путина.
Путин и его команда...
Эта власть заведет себя в тупик.
Я говорю, два года до конца режима.
То скоро придет конец этому режиму.
Что эпоха Путина действительно заканчивается?
Predictions of the Putin regime's imminent fall are a dime a dozen. We've all been hearing them for years. Some of us have made them. But this week, Nikolai Petrov, the Moscow-based political analyst, who I think is one of the most sober and astute observers of Russian domestic politics on the scene, made a very convincing case that this regime's days are, in fact, numbered. In fact, he got really specific and said the regime has about a year left of life in it. Don, were you convinced?
Well, I was convinced that he's a very brave guy for putting a timeline on it.
And that's unlike Nikolai is usually very cautious.
Quite impressive. I would give you a two-part answer, Brian. I do not think the regime is sustainable, but I think the regime will go or extend or survive relatively much longer than Kolya says. Not a year, probably several years. And then there are all those related questions we always talk about. Putinism without Putin, that kind of thing. But I definitely think it won't. Will last more than a year. The other issue I thought he brought up, which is extremely interesting, was the issue of a militarized society and whether Putin would invade someplace else to keep the population mobilized, because all signs are that the enthusiasm for this kind of thing is going down a little bit. And I thought the Colin show, the tone was a little bit a refutation of what Kolya said, because Putin spent a lot more time on domestic stuff than fascists in Kiev or whatever it might be. So I would answer then that kind of give you a multi-answer response, because I don't think it's going to be gone in a year.
Sean, what were your thoughts?
I'm always kind of, I don't really like this soothsaying,
right?
In terms of,
I know you
for me,
I know you
for
don't.
Me, it just fits into a very long tradition of the eternally collapsing Russia, right? Instead of trying to understand it as it is, there's this attempt to understand it where it's going. Now, I should say though, I don't know if the system is unsustainable, because instability just happens sometimes, right? It just comes out of the blue. It's unpredictable. And so I don't agree with the conclusions that Petrov is making, but I do think that some of his diagnosis of the symptoms are worth considering. The one I don't agree with is the military one, because
although, I mean, that was just one scenario he laid out there.
The militarism and Russia being addicted to military action. Because I mean, let's be honest here. However horrible and however we might not like or disagree with the military action in eastern Ukraine and in Syria, these are very small operations.
Right.
Militarily, they have no major impact on Russian society outside of propaganda. The society is not militarized for war. There aren't many casualties that we can identify. So the impact is actually quite small. But at the same time, I think that some of the other things he points out, like the hollowing out of institutions, elite conflict, these are all things that we have seen repeatedly throughout Russian history, but also in the last 16 years, that continually crop up and I think continually work to make the regime give a brittleness to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one thing I would also disagree with is I don't think 2014 was really a great break in all this. One can make an argument that 2011, 2012 was, right? Because if you say, okay, society is mobilized, the mobilization began in response to the protests, you'll remember, right?
Right.
The mobilizing these guys in the Ural tank, you know, factory to come to Moscow, the mobilization of the silent majority and Putin's re-election, the mobilization of the Buzhetniki to go against the liberals in the cities. And then, you know, Ukraine, the Maidan Revolution happens. Ukraine is just an extension, I think, of that.
Mm-hmm. I should point out to everybody that the article we're discussing is titled Putin's Downfall, The Coming Crisis of the Russian Regime by Nikolai Petrov. It was published on the website of the European Council on Foreign Relations this week. It's available free and you can download it and read it if you haven't already. One thing I want to do, I mean, Sean, I agree with you, the society is not militarized, but the point that Nikolai makes is that the legitimacy of the regime shifted from a kind of soft electoral legitimacy, and let's face it, it was kind of there, to a legitimacy based on Putin's charisma and on military success. Regardless of how extensive those military adventures were, it was more about the movie about the military success than about the actual military success itself. And that the regime is now kind of addicted to this now. They don't look really sure-footed when they shift to domestic concerns. Compare Putin last Thursday on his call-in show with Putin on his call-in show 2 years ago. The triumphalism you feel, the confidence he feels when he's talking about foreign affairs. Come on, with where he looks really unsure of himself when he's talking about dairy products. And like we said last week, he went from talking about, you know, a new Russian empire to talking about palm oil and Russian milk.
Zola from Bryansk.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's the reason Nikolai's making the argument that it's unsustainable. And I think there is something to that.
But I would say, first off, you know, superheroes in comic books rarely fight against the price of milk.
Right.
It's the triumphalism of foreign affairs is a standard theme of statecraft. And also, too, the militarism move, the move to foreign affairs, was because there were external issues that Russia had to address. The Putin could not just sit and allow, from his perspective. Yeah, and allow a revolution like in Ukraine to happen in a border state. He had to respond. From the Kremlin's perspective, he had to respond. And the way they responded, like it or not, is, you know, they had to do something. Syria, too, in terms of Russia seeing itself as a global power, the effort to provide some sort of balance of power and an end to a unipolar world, Russia intervenes in Syria. But you're right. that when it comes to domestic politics and domestic, the economic, social economic situation, the people in the Kremlin have no imagination. They don't know what to do with it because I think, as you said, in order to deal with it effectively, they would have to start removing key people, particularly in the localities, and they would have to whip those machines into shape. And that provides just potentially just as much a different kind of chaos, but a chaos nonetheless that they don't want to deal with.
What I found really compelling in the piece was not, I mean, the premise that the regime is unsustainable, I generally agree with. In terms of that, they've shifted to this charismatic, militaristic form of legitimacy. But the alternatives they have, and the alternatives are doubling down on repression, or instituting reforms, or changing the leader. Right? He's saying these are the alternatives, and every one of them leads to some kind of dead end. Right? As we pointed out in the first half. The kind of reforms that Russia needs to get out of this economic mess would undermine the fundamental foundations of the regime, right? Doubling down on repression, you don't know where that's going to end and what it's going to lead to, and that's potentially hazardous. Putinism without Putin, maybe. Don, what are your thoughts on these, the alternatives that are before this?
I think he outlined them very well, perhaps too starkly, and I don't think I would bet on any of those taking place right now, especially the issue of reforming the system. I think that all of those have occurred to certain people at the top, probably Bystrykin, and I think they are not at a place yet where they want to move decisively one way or the other. And that's one reason why you see this kind of dissonant set of messages coming out from the top. Brian, I thought it very important, and I'm happy that you mentioned the issue of legitimacy, because sustainability, I find a difficult concept to deal with, because I don't think systems rise or collapse. They usually evolve into something else. Mm-hmm. But I do think at the core of the system here, you have a legitimacy problem. I think you correctly mentioned the couch army. Who was it who said that? The couch army that watched the invasion of Ukraine on TV.
Right.
That's not a mobilized or militarized society. And second, you see the absolute let me say weird preoccupation with Putin's poll rating.
Yes.
And the fact that one or two points in one direction or the other somehow makes a difference for the legitimacy of the system. And I think that's a very dangerous situation, which compels elements in the elite to go in one of those three alternative directions that you mentioned.
One other thing that I came to mind this week, I don't know if you saw Gleb Pavlovsky's piece in Foreign Affairs about Systema, the whole Systema argument, but that basically regimes come and go in Russia, but Systema remains. Systema stayotsya. And this is an argument from the book Can Russia Modernize? But I mean, it's basically Pavlovsky's arguing this regime will fall in a day and be replaced by something exactly like it. And that regime will fall in a day and be replaced by something exactly like it. Systema remains. Is he right? Or does Systema evolve?
Yeah, this is for me. Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. And that's worrisome after all that's happened in the past 20 or 25 years. You have a question of, and I hate to say this, I will, of political values and culture here, of money and power, of centralized elites, of the sacralization of the czar, that kind of thing, which makes it very hard to break the conditions of confinement from top-down policies or a Kudrin reform program or even a Bystrykin crackdown. These things don't change easily overnight, and there's a reason why Poland or the Czech Republic evolved the way it did after the end of the Soviet Union, and Russia hasn't. And it has more to do with kind of deeper cultural and political issues than just a reform program or Putin's venality or whose corruption, whatever.
Well, this goes along the lines of something I've been arguing for a while, why what happens in Ukraine is actually very important for Russia.
Absolutely.
And I think the best thing that could ever happen to Russia, and this is a case I've made again and again and again, is for the reforms in Ukraine to be successful. Because I really think that would create not just because it would create a precedent and an example. I think it might provoke the catharsis that Don, you said that would maybe force change in these underlying cultural problems we're talking about.
Yeah, people sort of patronizingly here in the Washington precincts make fun of food fights in the Rada and that kind of thing going on in Kiev. But it's a mark of a vital, much more vital civil society than in Russia. Sloppy as it is, yeah, and disappointing as it often is, this is extremely important. And that's not going to change in Ukraine either by a Russian invasion or some kind of incompetent president at the top.
No, and it's not. And if you look at the history of Ukraine and Russia, it's basically like they were separated at birth. If you look at it from each of their very first post-Soviet political crises. In each case, you had the first post-Soviet president, nominally a reformist, facing a revanchist legislature. In Ukraine, it was solved by early elections in which the incumbent lost and stepped down. And in Russia, it was solved by the president shelling the parliament. And from that moment on, each of these two countries that are supposedly so similar and so interconnected developed in very different ways. In Ukraine, the result up to this point is kind of oligarchic pluralism, for lack of a better term. It's oligarchic pluralism. The society wants to go to the real article. The elite doesn't really want to go there yet. This is one of the ways that the Ukrainian society is. But Russia's not even to oligarchic pluralism yet. Sean, you're about to say something. You disagree with me.
I wanted to make a very, very crude, and if Kirill is listening, cover your ears, historical analogy, and that is the difference between Kiev and Rus and Muscovy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, this is these arguments about the development of early modern Russia come from this split and the movement of political power from, say, Kiev to Muscovy and the consolidation of the autocratic state beginning with Ivan III and Ivan Grozny. But that's a different – I want to go back and say something about the legitimacy question because I didn't address that. I don't think that Putin is in a legitimacy crisis. Nor do I think that his legitimacy is based on military, bravado and victory. This is just one of the means that helps his legitimacy, but I don't think they're completely reliant on it. I think his legitimacy remains for most Russians the same it has been since he came to power, and the same legitimacy that they keep bringing up, and that is stability. Now the problem is that right now things aren't stable.
Yeah. Well, this is what Nikolai was kind of driving. And I should add, we tried to get Nikolai on the program. Unfortunately, he's at a conference in Yekaterinburg and was incommunicado because I really wish he were here to get in this. But I think this is the argument he's making without putting it in those words, Sean. But I think that's similar to what he's.
And so I think the shift of the direct line to this domestic politics, and people were saying it a couple of weeks before that there's been a turn towards a return to domestic politics. First off, it is a pre-election thing, right? Because this is what people are going to vote on. It's also a movement, a way to try to address the economic crisis that the regime has ignored until now. And I mean, it hasn't done anything, concrete to deal with it, but it's basically ignored it for the most part.
But they don't – I think they ignored it for a reason. They don't have any – they can't do anything. They don't have any ideas. I mean, there was a great piece by Maxim Trudolubov on the Wilson Center site. I don't know if either of you saw it. Where he said basically it's hard work versus magic. That's the debate in the Russian elite. If you're an economist, you're looking at it and you're attributing all of this to kind of global factors and supply, demand and so on. If you're in the people that are actually making the decisions, who aren't the economists, it's a global plot against Russia, and what we can do is just wish for oil prices to rise. It's witchcraft versus governance in a lot of ways. And this is – they haven't addressed the economic crisis because they don't have any – there's nothing they can do right now. You have a rent-seeking economy with shrinking resources. And what are you going to do?
And also, I think you hit on a very important word, governance. The fact that things are so centralized in terms of A, legitimacy, and B, governance and governing institutions are centralized in the manual control of Putin. And I think this is another symptom that Petrov points out that's worth considering. the result of manual control prevents actually dealing with the crisis, because you need to govern in order to deal with it, and you need institutions to do that, and the institutions have been hollowed out. Look what happened in with the direct line. This is a perfect example of the manual control and the lack of governance. He speaks about economic issues. One of the issues that I've been following is people who are asking questions about wage arrears.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened with a wage arrears in the last week? You have the investigative committee claiming or announcing they're going to do a nationwide proverka,
right,
on wage arrears.
Somebody's already been arrested.
Right. There's already been arrests in the Far East. There was one article that pointed out within an hour, things started happening and moving based on Putin's comments. People were getting their back pay in a couple of locations, not all, but in some. This is a perfect example. The wage arrears problem has been an issue for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And it's only when Putin actually, you know, puts his finger on it that people in the context of now, because he put their same complaints were in last year's, and actually one of the guys who asked a question about wage arrears
was arrested because the wage arrears weren't taken care of.
You can bet
your bottom dollar that all these wage arrears that are being cleared up now are going to be a problem again in a couple of months.
They absolutely will. But this is a perfect example of how the manual control is all the governance they have, and you can't run a system this complex in a country this complex based on Putin, you know, controlling things with a joystick in the Kremlin.
Right. Don, your thoughts on this?
I very much agree, although I was thinking when they steamrolled food over the summer, whatever happened to that. I agree with you. I guess the question of control is an interesting word, because I agree with the term, but I think the call-in also shows that there is a lot of stuff out there that Putin doesn't control.
Absolutely.
And he suggests strongly, Papa suggests. And that really is a very daunting and discouraging thing for those of us who want this to go in a more reformed direction. The other point I would make, guys, is that I really have doubts that some of these people, especially around Putin, have any sense of public spiritedness, don't laugh, to talk about governance at all. I'm not sure they even get it. When we were in Moscow, we used to say that that Yeltsin is a Democrat. He just doesn't understand what it means. And these people try to govern, and I'm not sure they understand what it means. I mean, how do you convince Sechin or somebody that he's not entitled to his cut? That's the way he sees the society. And that's a very daunting thing for those of us who hope it goes in a more positive direction.
Well, bringing this all around full circle, I mean, there are people talking about governance, people like Kudrin, but he's clearly not going to be able to do anything.
He's writing reports, yeah.
Writing reports and being window dressing.
Another great example of this lack of governance is, remember the mine collapse last month or so, or a month and a half ago? They sent out Dvorkovich to go talk to the locals about the families of who lost miners in this collapse and this explosion. It was explosion, sorry. Mm-hmm. You should look up the transcript of this meeting with the residents of those mines and Dvorkovich. It's incredible because – one, they have to send Dvorkovich out there, right? Someone from Moscow to deal with a local matter. So they have really no one there to deal with it effectively. Two, the anger from the people in the crowd is really telling, because it shows that, A, Russians are not passive politically. They yelled at a central politician in a way that I've never seen in the United States. It's quite extraordinary. But it just goes to show that between Dvorkovich and the Kremlin and the local residents out there in Siberia, there's nothing in between.
Right. Right. Except the direct line.
Except the direct line. Yeah. Which is a souped up technology improved, cameras and all, of the old peasants appealing to the Tsar,
right,
with written petitions or letters to Stalin that the Russian archives are full of.
Right. And it used to be a good show, but this year was an exception. Don, any last thoughts before we wrap it up for the week?
No, only that I do think the election season as it approaches is likely to give a rise to a number of unexpected events that bear very close watching. And I don't think, no matter how they try to have a blueprint for how to handle it, I don't think it's going to go necessarily all that smoothly. Not only because they can't control everything, but I think there's a lot of good examples of election cycles bringing up a nepotism. And I think from their point of view, as you said earlier, Brian, they're right to be concerned, even as I think largely they will come through more or less.
Mm. Sean, your last thoughts, anything?
The Putin system is often seen as a, you know, electoral authoritarianism. The elections are there to legitimize the system. The whole question of the role of the elections. But what is shown, particularly in the last 10 years or so, that elections, whether they're parliamentary or presidential, are periods of great political uncertainty and, to some extent, instability.
Yeah, no, this is the importance of the elections. They're a show, but the show's got to go off very well.
That's right. It's a show, but in the old Russian tradition, changes of power, however slight they may be, particularly at the presidential level, are always times where all sorts of people come out of the woodwork. And we have our example of Bastrykin and Kudrin, who are vying for positions and vying for influence and vying for attempt to put their narrative on the process. And I think Don is absolutely right in the sense that we're going to see more of this in the coming months from a variety of different places. And it will be interesting. But it shows that while elections in Russia may not be important in terms of electing people, it is important for looking at and understanding what this system is all about.
Yeah, it's a legitimizing ritual. It's theater. And it's also important diagnostically.
But right? It's also a delegitimizing ritual.
It can be.
Because all of the worms in the can start crawling out.
Right. No, I think you're right. I mean,
the way Sean, at its core, there's a contradiction between the actual distribution of power and the formal rules that Brian just mentioned. And some worm, as you said, is going to come out of the closet or wherever you said they come and say, "How about this?"
Right.
And that causes a permanent tension.
Yeah. No, we're almost going to see systema conflict with the formal processes. And I mean, my last words would be, I'm not sure if my good friend Nikolai is right and we just have this regime's got about a year of life in it, but I do know one thing: this is going to be one hell of a bumpy year. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining us from Washington, D.C. has been veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations and the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. You should also all subscribe to Sean's new email newsletter. Thank you both for an enlightening and interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. You can also follow Pavel's excellent feed on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.